Hello there, it's me, Michelle Cortins, that person who publishes episodes, but you caught me without posting one all summer. I was swept away by the hustle and bustle of the season, so thanks for understanding. On today's episode of the Orchard Outlook podcast, you might wonder why we're talking about millet, mustard, and canola on an orchard podcast. It's not for a salad, folks. No, we have far greater motives. Think big, like pre-plant cover cropping to improve soil health and sequester carbon. If there's a benefit to be gained, we want to know about it. So, we've dipped our hands into the bag of seeds on this topic, and so has our guest speaker. She has information to share on multi-year approaches, what cover crops are promising, and how we get the most bang for our buck. We're sowing seeds for the future. Now, let's welcome our guest, Tiana DuPont. Hello, Tiana.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm super excited.
Great. So let's just get right into it. What I really want to know is, how did you come to work on soil health in orchard replant situations? And kind of related to that, what's your current role?
Sure. Yeah, so I moved to Washington in 2015 and went around and interviewed orchardists and other stakeholders to say, hey, what are your key challenges? What's really critical for you? And one of the issues that rose to the top was replant disease and kind of the long-lasting effects that can have on an orchard when you end up in that bad situation where it wasn't quite done right, or maybe it was done right, but it still didn't work out. And I'd previously worked with cover crops in other systems in Pennsylvania, so in vegetables and small grains. And so it seemed like a good fit, somewhere where I had some experience, where there was a need, and where I could contribute. So I started working on that. And also, I was really lucky that Dr. Mark Mazzola with the USDA had been doing quite a bit of work that was ready for field application. So in my current role, I'm an extension specialist. So I'm working with growers to scale up some of the research that other folks have been doing, get it applied out in the field, and then also help growers learn and apply that information is kind of my piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. And similarly, when I started in 2017, I was hearing about replant disease too. So it's a topic that's been talked about here year after year. So it's great to see that there's cover crop research kind of going on in the field. So we're going to jump into that today. I've heard you talk before, and you were talking about a soil health investigation in Washington orchards. Could you explain how that project compared high and low yielding blocks to focus in on soil health constraints?
Sure. That's a fun project. So growers are hearing a lot about soil health these days. We talk about the rhizosphere and the microbiome, and growers were asking me, so what does this mean for me? What is soil health, and how does it relate to my bottom line, yield, packouts, and profitability specifically? And so we wanted to look at which, if any, soil health indicators were related to yield and packout. So we measured 21 different soil health indicators in side-by-side blocks, a little over 100 different orchards. One orchard block was a high-yielding block, so a block the grower is pretty happy with, and another where they had a challenge where it's not meeting its yield potential that they thought might be related to soil. We worked hard to try and make sure that those blocks were pretty well matched, so similar scion, rootstock, training system, so that we can compare what might be derived from soil health rather than other factors. So we excluded crop load and irrigation with other measurements. And what we found out was that some of the soil health indicators that were really important were related to water or root health. So for example, the water-related factors that were interesting in this experiment were available water capacity and percent sand, which were related to yield. And then also root health ratings and Pratelenchus nematodes had moderate effects on our yields.
Okay, interesting. So that those were kind of a common theme, like across a few different constraints.
Yeah. So when we look at you know, all those 110 blocks, and about three quarters of them were ones that were well enough matched that we could actually make comparisons, and did some fancy modeling with the statistician that I was working with, and found that that's where we had significant effects on yield overall. And when you looked at individual sites, you could then see those examples where, wow, this is an example where we had a lot of Pratelanchus nematodes and a big difference between the yield in those two blocks. So nothing earth-shattering. Nobody's going to be surprised that replant and water availability are important. But it is a little bit different than what some of the other studies might focus on with soil health, where we tend to look at things like organic matter that are sort of more broadly applicable in a conservation conversation.
Okay, very interesting. When we start talking about cover crops, do those help to address some of those soil health constraints? Is there like a benefit to cover cropping in orchards?
Yeah, so that is a really good question, right? So cover crops in orchards and other perennial systems are a lot more challenging than in other systems where we're rotating and you have time between your bok choy and your next crop to put in a cover crop. We might have our orchard in the ground for 10, 20 years. And so there's not a lot of windows for that cover crop between plantings. And then where we are in Washington, it's really dry. And so also between those plantings, we might not have water, irrigation water available if folks have taken out all their infrastructure. Some folks have looked at intercropping, so growing a living cover crop across your whole orchard. And recently I did a review looking at a number of those studies. There was 8 studies that I could find where folks had grown that living cover crop. And in those studies, 6 of 8 actually had a negative impact of the cover crop because probably those cover crops were competing in the root zone where they were growing it right in the tree row. So I would say we want to be careful about how we use cover crops in an orchard system so that we're getting the benefits of the organic matter and the living roots, but without that competition where we can have a decrease in yield, at least in the short term, from that cover crop competition.
So they might play more of a role in like a pre-plant situation.
Yeah. So the two windows where I see cover crops the easiest to use in an orchard system are pre-plant, if you have water available. So in the rainy part of the country where you guys are.
Yeah.
And then also we can talk about the mow and blow as a potential technique as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to ask you about that later. So for now, if somebody is considering using cover crops, would you recommend like a multi-year approach with several different species?
Yeah, so you guys might know Dr. John Halbrenth, who is a nematologist out in Pennsylvania. He developed a really nice multi-species cover crop scenario for pre-plant, particularly where you're worried about dagger nematode. But it does a nice job for multiple types of nematodes and fungi for replant as well. And so he recommends a summer Sudan grass followed by a fall and then a spring canola or rapeseed. Dwarf Essex was the variety that we most commonly used out there. And so those cover crops are chopped and incorporated, so they have a biorenovation effect where the active volatile compounds in that cover crop are being released into the soil and reducing your soil fungi and soil nematode levels. And so, you know, what I always talk to people about is that orchard's going to be in the ground for a long time. So really utilize that window before you plant to try and build up your organic matter, because that organic matter has so many benefits, both in terms of water holding capacity and providing food for those microorganisms that are counteracting the pathogens in the soil. And so even though it takes time, I mean, if you follow Dr. Halbrenth's methodology, that's a year out of crop to do all three of those cover crops. But that can really help benefit you later.
For sure. Yeah. So it's an actual program that you have to do over time to really see kind of like a long-term benefit.
Well, that particular program is, you know, targeted towards nematodes. Certainly you're going to see reductions with each of those cover crops. You know, two reasons that there's the succession there. One is, you know, if you're thinking about dagger nematode, then your tolerance is really low for having any of them left compared to lesion nematode, where we're just trying to reduce that number as much as possible. But certainly growing any cover crop is going to put organic matter back into the soil. So I would say I would always talk to people with about cover crops in terms of thinking about what's your objective. You know, are you trying to build organic matter? Are you trying to reduce disease? And you might have multiple objectives, but if you have a primary objective, you can choose what cover crop to use and when to use and how to use it based on that goal. So for example, if your goal is organic matter, you have a lot more latitude of what you can do, right? You're just going to try and grow carbon. So certainly a simple, just one cover crop, fall grass. We use oats or rye out here a lot. And pearl millet might be an interesting one to use because it's not only going to grow carbon for you, but also is thought to not be a host for lesion nematode. And so hopefully reduce your populations with that as you're doing it. For folks out here that aren't as familiar with cover crops, that's what we've been talking the most about, is just, is there a way to fit in a fall planted cover crop where when we have a little rain to grow some organic matter, and, you know, keep the dust down and all that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense. So even if you can't commit to like a long-term cover crop program, it's still worth it to try something, identify your goals and kind of see if it helps out.
That's the strategy I would use, but also identify your constraints. What equipment do you have available? What water do you have available? What's your timing? Because it's, you know, kind of sad when we spend money and time on planting a cover crop, but we got it in so late that it doesn't have a chance to really do much growth late over the fall.
And along those same lines, does the cover crop need to be like amended with nutrients to get the full effect of the cover crop?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So working with orchardists, realizing, wow, folks are not used to growing cover crops, we really want to think about the fertility and water needs for those cover crops. So specifically, if you're growing Sudan grass and mustards for that biorenovation type program, mustards really like nitrogen, and you won't get enough biomass if the fertility levels are super low. But also they have that compound glucosinolate that, when it reacts with the enzyme myrinase, is what produces the isocyanates that are active. And if you don't have enough sulfur in the soil, you're not going to have that reaction happen properly. So it's definitely important to fertilize for your cover crop in order to get the best benefit. And the added complication in orchards is that fertility is then going to be recycled. So thinking about, do you want all the fertility that cover crop is going to need for your next crop if you're worried about your potassium, calcium balance, and so forth?
So what's usually involved in maintaining a cover crop and then terminating it?
You know, like anything, it's going to depend a little bit on the cover crop that you choose. So with your grasses, you have a little bit more flexibility because it's a little bit bigger seed. With the canola and rapeseed, they're pretty small seeds. And so you need to start with a fine seed bed. You got to actually get things relatively flat and disc it and so forth before you start. We talked about that fertility. Irrigation or sufficient rainfall is going to be important. So thinking about when you have that window of moisture. And then for these biorenovation cover crops, there's kind of three key components. The first is to grow sufficient amount of cover crop, because that cover crop that has compounds that are in the plant biomass. So if you don't grow enough cover crop, you're not going to have enough active compound, in this case, glucosinolate, and or in the case of sorghum Sudan grass, durin, in order to do what you're trying to do. The second piece is that for these bioactive compounds to work, there's a sulfur as part of the enzymatic process when you're working with glucosinolate. And so if you don't have enough sulfur fertility, you won't have that enzymatic process happen. The third key to effective biorenovation is chopping and incorporating that material quickly. So the mustard has glucosinolate in one part of the plant cell and an enzyme in another part of the plant cell. And when you chop it, that mixes that together, creates a chemical reaction. But if you just go through with a woods mower and cut it down, you're not chopping that plant material, and so you won't get the chemical reaction. But you need to then incorporate that material quickly so that those lovely volatile compounds you're creating don't just escape into the atmosphere. You want to incorporate them down into the soil where they're going to do their work. So I've had the best luck when folks have two tractors, one cutting, flailing that material, and another coming behind or jumping over to that other tractor and disking in or rototilling in the material so that you really quickly, within a couple of minutes, incorporate that material and ideally seal the soil surface either with an irrigation or a cultipacker to keep those active compounds in the soil.
Yeah. Okay. And so why might cover cropping not be practiced widely in orchards? We kind of talked about some of the barriers, but is there anything else you want to bring up?
Yeah, sure. So like I mentioned before, two of the barriers in Eastern Washington are just water availability and then time between those two plantings. We're seeing kind of more and more folks thinking about that window. And so the other thing is just experience and equipment to, you know, get it figured out. So get to know your neighbors that do forages, that know how to grow cover crops, and it'll help you out a lot.
Yeah, excellent. We actually just had a cover cropping workshop recently with a mixture of different commodities. And that's right. It was good to hear different perspectives. So yeah, really good point. So after trees are established, where it's kind of harder to incorporate cover crops into an orchard, but a person might actually want to continue getting the benefits of organic matter. You had mentioned the mow and blow technique. So is that a good option? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Mow and blow is something where I throw that term around and then I realize it's not a real term. Nobody knows what that means. So mow and blow is where when folks are growing a grass cover crop in the grass strip or the drive row, which is, you know, pretty common. But then they have either a specific mower or a modified mower that blows that grass clippings into the tree row so that the majority, or actually when we measured it was more like 20 to 40% of the grass that you're mowing is ending up under the trees and creating a mulching type effect. So it's conserving water, keeping that water environment kind of more stable, oftentimes in the root zone, as well as increasing organic matter in that area. And so, for example, some work that was done in Washington a number of years ago now by David Granstein, they found that by doing that, they increased the tree growth of young trees, non-bearing trees. And then another study with Sanchez, they did the mow and blow with, again, a grass in the grass strip and increased both their organic matter by about 20%, as well as their tree growth and yield by 10 to 16%. So it depends on the amount of organic matter that you're putting over there and the number of years. But we have quite a few growers in Washington that are doing that mow and blow and are quite happy with it.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and for sharing so much great information. And I want to wish you a happy harvest season.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I hope to come and see what you guys are doing sometime.
Follow me on Twitter at NSTreeFruit and follow Perennia on Facebook and Twitter at NSPerennia. Thanks to Perennia for sowing information in the podcast space. Thank you to Patty Ryan for her marketing management. And thank you to growers for asking the most high-yielding questions. Here's a fun fact. The Nova Scotia Orchard Tour trekked to 5 different orchards in early August, and the bus almost got stuck only once. I consider that a success.